Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Republicans won America's swingiest swing state by talking up trade and immigration. Can Democrats win it back by talking about pensions, Social Security, and Medicare? Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to another edition of Politico's Nerdcast. I'm Scott Bland, your host. This week on the Nerdcast, we've got two segments, and we'll start with the dramatic hearing on Capitol Hill for Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Plus, looking ahead to the midterms, there are 435 House seats, but we're going to talk about the ways in which this is really one giant national election and a few examples of how it isn't. A quick reminder to our listeners before we get started, please subscribe to the Nerdcast, rate us, and write a review if you haven't already. All right, let's begin. Time for our first data point, 100. Christine Blasey Ford said today that she is 100% certain that it was Brett Kavanaugh who assaulted her at a drunken high school party in Maryland in 1982. The boy who sexually assaulted me, she called him before the Senate Judiciary Committee today in raw testimony. Kavanaugh denied the allegation in a forceful opening statement of his own, followed by hours of his testimony. This confirmation process has become a national disgrace, Kavanaugh thundered. The Constitution gives the Senate an important role in the confirmation process, but you have replaced advice and consent with search and destroy. So we're taping this segment now just after the hearing ended on Thursday evening. We've got two guests with us. On the line from Capitol Hill, Politico's Marianne Levine was covering the hearings today. Marianne, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And with me here at Politico, White House reporter Andrew Restuccia. Andrew, good to see you as well.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to step back and talk about the consequences of the hearing here in a moment. But first, let's walk through the hearing itself. We'll give you a sense of what happened over many hours today with a few clips of the most salient moments. The first is an exchange between Blasey Ford and Senator Dianne Feinstein of California and Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont, both Democrats on the committee.
How are you so sure that it was he?
The same way that I'm sure that I'm talking to you right now. It's just basic memory functions and also just the level of norepinephrine and epinephrine in the brain that sort of, as you know, encodes, that neurotransmitter encodes memories into the hippocampus. And so the trauma-related experience then is kind of locked there, whereas other details kind of drift.
So what you are telling us is this could not be a case of mistaken identity.
Absolutely not.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What is the strongest memory you have? Strongest memory of the incident, something that you cannot forget. Take whatever time you need.
Indelible in the hippocampus is the laughter, the uproarious laughter between the two, and they're having fun at my expense.
You've never forgotten that laughter. You've never forgotten them laughing at you.
They were laughing with each other.
And you were the object of the laughter?
I was, you know, underneath one of them while the two laughed. Two friends having a really good time with one another.
Usually a hearing has Republican and Democratic senators both questioning a witness, but the 11 Republicans on the committee, all men, as was covered extensively in the days leading up to this hearing, instead turned their time over to an Arizona prosecutor hired for this occasion named Rachel Mitchell. She's a sex crimes prosecutor from Arizona's largest county who tried to dig in on the specifics of Blasey Ford's recollections. Who paid for her lie detector test? Why the other people she recalled being at the party hadn't corroborated her story? Things like that.
You did take a polygraph, and that was on August the 7th. Is that right?
I believe so. It's the day I was flying from BWI to Manchester, New Hampshire.
Okay. Why did you decide to take a polygraph?
I didn't see any reason not to do it.
Later, when Brett Kavanaugh appeared, the judge was striking a balance of an indignant outrage at the accusations and the Senate process.
After I have been in the public arena for 26 years without even a hint, a whiff
of an allegation like this. And when my nomination to the Supreme Court was just about to be voted on at a time when I'm called evil by a Democratic member of this committee, while Democratic opponents of my nomination say people will die if I am confirmed.
And a respect for his accuser, who he indicated must be mistaken somehow about the identity of the person who assaulted her. Kavanaugh said several times that he had no reason to doubt that Blasey Ford was assaulted by someone, but said it was not him. There was also a lot of raw emotion on display from Kavanaugh. He choked up several times, particularly when describing his family and friends.
The other night, Ashley and my daughter Liza said their prayers, and little Liza, all of 10 years old, said to Ashley, we should pray for the woman. It's a lot of wisdom from a 10-year-old.
The Kavanaugh questions and answers were stayed, at least to start, until Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican from South Carolina, lit into the Democrats on the Judiciary Committee and concluded by saying to Judge Kavanaugh that,
you're looking for a fair process? You came to the wrong town at the wrong time, my friend.
He seemed to amplify the anger and emotion that Kavanaugh was feeling. And from then on, the Republican senators no longer relied on the Arizona prosecutor, Rachel Mitchell, and instead used their time to criticize the Democrats on the panel and defend the judge. So, given how political and polarized things were coming into the hearing, let alone how it went, was there anything here likely to sway the maybe half dozen or so senators who seemed to be on the fence about this confirmation vote? Marianne, part of your job today was kind of chasing people around the halls and figuring out what people had to say about this testimony. What did you learn?
I learned from being here on the Hill that many of the Republicans who had already made up their minds about Kavanaugh were not going to change their minds in terms of voting in favor of him. Some of the Republican senators who appear to be on the fence, including Jeff Flake, told Politico that he was still listening, and that was pretty much the extent of what he said. So we have not heard from the key senators who are the potential swing votes, but most of the senators going into this hearing on both sides appear to have had their minds made up prior to hearing testimony from Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh.
And those key senators who are going to be paying attention to in the coming days, folks like Alaska's Lisa Murkowski and Maine's Susan Collins, both Republicans, and then, of course, a handful of Democrats who voted for Neil Gorsuch last year, like Joe Donnelly and Heidi Heitkamp and Joe Manchin. Andrew, what was the White House's reaction to the testimony today?
So I think there were basically two reactions from the White House. The first was in the aftermath, and actually during the middle of Ford's testimony, there was a definite feeling of panic. You saw current and former White House officials basically acknowledging that Ford's testimony was credible and was something that they couldn't just sweep aside. They felt like she came off as sort of a regular person, not overly rehearsed. It was sort of difficult. One person told me it was difficult to make the case that she was this was all about politics for her, right? But then you saw something, a really marked shift as soon as Kavanaugh began to speak. He came out quite defiant in his very lengthy opening statement. And then you saw Lindsey Graham basically give not only Trump, but the other Republicans on the committee permission to voice all of the many concerns that they've had throughout this whole process. And the whole, as you mentioned, the whole hearing, the tone of it changed, and it turned into a reason to bash Democrats. So overall, I think the White House feels like this went about as good as it could for them.
Given the circumstances.
There's, of course, no guarantee, right, that Kavanaugh is still going to be confirmed. We have to wait and see what these other senators decide. The White House ultimately isn't going to control their vote. But at the end of the day, I think they're pretty happy.
Marianne, the Republican senators are meeting behind closed doors literally as we speak right now. And this story is moving by the hour and probably will have changed somewhat by the time folks are listening to this on Friday morning. But we could have votes potentially starting on this in terms of moving the nomination forward as soon as Friday.
Yes, no one has said otherwise. In response to questions from reporters, Senate Judiciary Committee Chair Chuck Grassley did not respond to questions about whether or not the vote was going to be moved. So as of now, we can say that the vote is probably going, or nothing has changed in terms of scheduling of the vote as of 7:30 tonight.
Got it. Andrew, let's step back a little, especially knowing how quickly this
right.
is changing.
Things are changing every second.
There's some stuff that we know right now in terms of, and that you've done some interesting reporting on the long-term ramifications of this process and what's happened with this nomination. Everything that's happened in the last few weeks with Blasey Ford coming forward leading up to the hearing today, you wrote, is going to change the way nominees for the Supreme Court and probably a lot of other positions as well are treated and vetted from here on out. And Kavanaugh himself said this, that there was a grotesque and coordinated character assassination against him that will keep people from serving the country, he said.
Yeah, you know, I talked to a lot of Democrats, Republicans, conservative liberals, veterans of the Supreme Court process for this story, and I think you're going to see a very different process from here on out for every Supreme Court nominee, probably for every cabinet secretary, probably for every vice presidential pick, that, you know, these FBI background checks, which there's been so much discussion about. Kavanaugh went through 6 background checks over the course of his service in government, but they often don't look into anything before the age of 18, unless you're arrested or something like that. But so it wouldn't automatically uncover, for example, a sexual assault, as Kavanaugh is facing right now, or even more minor issues like binge drinking or the other things that have sort of been brought up in this process. So I think you're going to have it's going to be up to the vetting teams and the people who are vetting these nominees to decide and to actually look into these things, you know, high school keg parties, college fraternity behavior, all of the stuff that has come up in this nomination is going to be fair game for the first time.
I'm just struck by the scale of the ask at that point to vet someone. I mean, how do you?
That's the question. It's basically impossible, right? But you always run the risk of someone coming forward, right? So you have to. People are saying that you're going to have to talk to ex-girlfriends from high school and college, ex-roommates from college, friends and acquaintances in high school, to get a full picture of a person. You may not uncover a potential sexual assault allegation or anything else really serious, but you can make a risk calculation about the likelihood of something like that happening. So one sort of unintentional consequence of this is you may see more nominees from diverse, more diverse backgrounds, whether that be, you know, racial or gender or just different experiences in life, right? There's only been 6 people who've served in the Supreme Court who aren't white men in the history of our country. And a vast majority of the people who've served on the Supreme Court have been in college fraternities, for example, right? So, you know, in terms of making a risk calculation, especially when it comes to sexual assault, there are some ways to be more likely to avoid something like that in the future. Doesn't mean it's fair, but, you know, if you're a president, like, you have to do what you have to do to make sure you get your nominee through.
That's a really good point. And, you know, we're probably going to see more examples of how this plays out as soon as next year.
Exactly.
Not with the Supreme Court, but with, you know, there could be cabinet changes after the midterms. There could be any number of things. You know, if not next year, certainly beyond 2020,
right.
whether President Trump is reelected or someone else is elected to replace him. Well, thank you guys so much for joining this evening after this marathon day of hearings to break it all down for us. Marianne, we'll let you get back to chasing those senators around the hall and figuring out what's going on there on the Capitol. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me.
And Andrew, thank you as always for walking us through all that.
No problem.
Today's episode is sponsored by AARP. Republicans won America's swingiest swing state by talking up trade and immigration. Can Democrats win it back by talking about pensions, Social Security, and Medicare? The latest issue of Politico magazine's series, The Deciders, is examining working-class voters over 50 who are feeling economic anxiety and could decide the gubernatorial and senatorial elections this November. Visit politico.com/thedeciders to learn more and to view the latest Politico AARP poll results.
All right, let's move on to our second data point of this episode, which is 40. We've got 40 days to go until the November midterm elections and the big question hanging over that election is what's happening in the House. And what we want to talk about today is the extent to which the House is effectively a national election or 435 little miniature elections. And I think Elena Schneider, our campaigns reporter, is in the studio, has some very strong thoughts about this. Hello, Elena. Welcome back.
Hey, Scott.
And also on the line, we have David Siders, our national political correspondent, on the line from California. Hi, David.
Hi, Scott.
All right. So why don't we start by setting some baselines? Elena, you've been digging into all of this for well over a year now. What are the compelling reasons that you see to expect a big Democratic result in the House in a couple months? And that some of them have been building for a while. Some of them are pretty new on the scene, but they're all kind of coming together to kind of fill in pieces of the puzzle.
Well, if we're defining big Democratic result as flipping the House, so just getting 23 seats here, look, there are a couple of things that really set the table for Democrats in a great way for them. So first of all, we've got historical precedent. It's the first midterm election of a first-term president who's got control of all the levers of power in Washington. Historically, we see a rejection when that happens, that the party out of power has a lot more success. So we already, though, see evidence and data points that that's already manifested itself. So off-year elections, the Virginia gubernatorial races and legislative races, we saw Democrats have victories up and down the ballot there. And then every special election that we've seen out of these House races, obviously not all of them Democrats won. Of course, Connor Lamb in southwestern Pennsylvania was a huge victory for them and a Trump plus 20 district. But in each one of these special elections, even though Democrats lost in most of them, they were able to improve their performance significantly, sometimes by close to double, but usually high single digits. And that speaks to the breadth of the map that they feel like they can contend with here. And that's why Democrats feel like they've got anywhere from, 60 to 80 races, which maybe is ballooning it a little bit too far for them to play with. And that's what they need. They need a lot of room. They need a lot of spread in which a couple races here and there that can go offline, they can go somewhere else. So the breadth of the battlefield. Then in the last year, we've seen time and time again, every quarter, that Democratic challengers have raised enormous sums of money. And that is a pretty significant because that's an indicator of energy, right? That's where it shows that these candidates are catching fire, people are paying attention, and they want to fund their campaigns. So last quarter, 56 Republican incumbents were outraised. That's a pretty significant chunk, even in the historical context. Things haven't looked that bad for the party in power for quite some time. And then even just recently, we've seen in August, we saw some pretty blockbuster numbers for Democratic candidates it's raising online.
Small donors, and that's, again, getting into this enthusiasm question.
Exactly. So he's not running for the House, but Beto O'Rourke, who's running in Texas, raised more than $9 million in 1 month. That is like a good whole cycle for a Senate campaign, and he was able to do it in 1 month. And we've seen that in a number of different down ballot races where they're raising just hundreds of thousands of dollars online and it's sustained. I know there was a lot of questions, and I've talked about it here before, of after the John Ossoff race down in Georgia last summer, there was this question of he got so much money, he was really well funded. Was this going to be able to sustain itself? We have our answer now. Yes, it's been able to sustain itself. So all of those factors are swirling around to create a really good environment. But sort of the looming element to all of this is Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And he's what is putting so many of these, in particular, suburban districts in reach for Democrats for the first time.
Right. And David, we've been seeing in terms of those national numbers, right? Donald Trump isn't at the lowest point in his presidency, but he's still unpopular. Democrats aren't at the highest point that they've been in any generic ballot polling ever, like the national House vote, would you vote for a Democrat or Republican? But they're pretty far up there, right? Like all those national signs are there as well.
Yeah, all those national indications are there. The threshold's what, below 50%? And that's where he's been. I think if there's any concern about the generic ballot, it's that it's been a little bit all over the place, but that should be more instructive, I think, closer to November. Boy, Elena makes a strong case. There's nothing to argue with there.
Well, and on top of this, now we've got we've got a lot of polling coming out in individual House races that's been very interesting. We've got the New York Times is doing this big project where they're polling dozens and dozens of districts, and we're getting to see, you know, kind of on the ground level, individual, place by place, how the president's doing, what people are thinking about their votes, and all that is painting, you know, certainly in terms of the president and the national environment is painting a pretty dire picture for a lot of Republicans. But now, Elena, I'm going to force you to turn right back around and argue with yourself a little bit here now, because David won't do it for us. What are some of the signs that the GOP might be able to hang on here?
Because
it's not a foregone conclusion.
Totally.
At this point. No strategists think it is.
It's not. It's definitely not a foregone conclusion that the Democrats are going to flip the House. And here's why. So unlike 2010, where we saw Republicans gain 63 seats, which was just a massive shift in the House, we can already say that is not going to happen in 2018. What they really can rely on, and sort of, again, going back to the basics of the way that this year has shaped up, is the fact that they won those 63 seats back in 2010 and had all those legislative victories right before a redistricting year. Republicans were able to draw the maps in so many different states that advantaged their incumbents. And it sort of spread out these 55-45 as in sort of like these safe, generally safe-ish seats, so that they could sort of make the highest number of Republican incumbents out of these maps. We wrote a story about this based on North Carolina and Ohio, where sort of looking at all of these races that actually hadn't been competitive in years because they were so safe. And so that's what Democrats, sort of the first hurdle that Democrats are up against, is an incredibly difficult map where, even though I said at the top, like 60, 80 seats that they want, they hope, they claim that they have, then in fact, it's a much smaller that map than it could be because of the way that these things are redistricted.
The one thing I would add to that is that a lot of these incumbents have been around at this point for a while because of that. And as we look at some of this district by district polling, what we're seeing so far is that, even though a lot of the indicators look good for Democrats, there are still a lot of districts where Republican incumbents are tied or ahead. Now, they might be tied or slightly ahead at below 50%, right? Maybe they're up like 45, 44. And I think we would probably both say that that's kind of a dangerous sign.
Right.
Anyways.
They would be very nervous no matter what.
But, it's not done, right? Like, Democrats still have to try and put those candidates away. Who knows? There's always the chance of October surprises and things like that. But David, it really seems like the polarizing nature of Trump's presidency has made this a national election in a way that not every midterm is.
Well, I think no doubt Trump's having an effect. He appears in just a ton of ads all over the country, but I don't think we can pin this entirely or maybe even mostly on the president. I mean, House races have become increasingly nationalized over the past quarter century, and that's long before Trump was on the scene. So I think you do have to attribute it that, maybe to the diminished power of incumbency. And I think also a more fractured media market where the conversation almost, or the attentions of the public almost, are forced to these national connections instead of maybe when there used to be a stronger local presence in news, having more personal connections with the lawmaker. So I think that that's been something that's been going on for 25 years and exacerbated now because of the polarizing nature of Trump. But I don't think it's a new thing.
That's a great point. And actually, you'll both like this little segue. I feel like Minnesota is a great place to look for this, right? The nationalization of this election. You've got Republican incumbents in the Twin Cities area who are under real pressure because a lot of their college-educated constituents have just abandoned the party, according to the polling over Trump. But you've got Democratic seats in the Iron Range and kind of the rural southern portion of the state that Republicans could end up flipping.
Yeah, we've seen a real shift in the kinds of districts that both sides are targeting. And we even saw this played out in the Ohio special election just a couple of weeks ago, where Republicans once were able to boost their sort of country club, suburban, we want everything to be stable and get, you know, cuts in our taxes sort of constituents. And those were the people they could rely on. And instead, they've seen a huge surge in interest among rural voters and those sorts of people in the Iron Range who were electing Colin, who, you know, have been electing Colin Peterson and Rick Nolan, who just announced he was retiring, to Minnesota Democrats who have held those seats for a long time. They're now seeing that disappear because those rural voters are really, really like this president and like the way that he talks and like the way that he speaks to them. And so, and in contrast, Democrats feel like they have this real opening in suburban areas. So we have seen a really interesting shift in terms of sort of the kinds of demographics that both parties are now going for.
You know, it might be a swing back from the 2010 election, but it's not going to be played over the same battlefield.
Exactly.
And, you know, I'm not sure. I think one of those Minnesota districts might have flipped in 2010, but it was not that was not a central piece of the House map, whereas now it very much is. Right, David?
No, I think that's right. And what's interesting to me in some of these middling districts is that they're, at least from what I can tell with Trump's, despite Trump's polarization, I think there's some uncertainty on both sides about how he plays in this election. And so you see, you know, Democrats running some advertisements that they almost attack Trump, but not really. They maybe instead put a picture of Paul Ryan up on the screen and talk about Washington insiders. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty about how he plays, because look at Minnesota, for example. Tim Pawlenty is a good example of, Republicans who go against the grain, I think, have paid a price in the primaries. And so if you're a Republican looking for signs of optimism, it's that at least with the base, Trump's a motivating factor.
Mm-hmm. And he kind of gives you an avenue to make sure that you're attracting some voters.
Right. And these Republicans are always having to contend with the fact that they can't lose that base. Right. I mean, there's some like Eric Paulson who released an ad where he said, you know, I stood up to the president on protecting, I think it was on waterways in Minnesota. He knows that he can sort of make that bet that there are probably enough Republicans who dislike the president that he feels safe in doing that. But there are a lot of Republicans, you know, take Steve Chabon in Ohio or some of these other sort of Republicans who are having to contend with a split, a suburban and rural split. They want to show independence from the president while also not doing so much so that it alienates and prevents their own base from actually turning out. And that's sort of the fine line that they're all being forced to walk.
It's a really tough line. And that's how this the kind of nationalization of the election has put folks like Paulson in a tough spot. We've talked about a lot about Barbara Comstock in Northern Virginia, Mike Kaufman in suburban Denver, out in Colorado. These are incumbents who, as Republicans have been talking about for over a year now, they're battle tested, right? They've kind of been through these big electoral tests in blue trending areas before, but we're starting to get signs that maybe they've never seen anything quite like this and had to deal with anything quite like this. One thing that I have found interesting, though, over the last few weeks, it does seem like there are a few of these battle-test incumbents who are just kind of defying the gravity of the moment right now. And I think that's so interesting. David, one of them in California, David Valadao in the Central Valley, this is a district, a heavily Hispanic district that elects or that votes for Democratic presidential candidates by enormous margins. And yet, Democrats can't seem to lay a finger on him at the congressional level so far.
No, and never have been. I mean, Republican registration in that district might be, I think it hovers around 30% most years. It's nothing. And really, if you just looked at the numbers, Valadao has no business being the congressman from that district. But he has connections to ag. He's relatively moderate. And he's likable. And I think, you know, for a candidate like that, the incumbent Republican who, as you mentioned, is battle-tested. I mean, they look at these races and they say, you know, listen, the Democratic mantra that we can flip seats because Hillary Clinton carried them in 16, you know, they look back and they say, we won our races even when Trump was on the ballot. And as much as you want to nationalize this election, I mean, people had a pretty good impression or understanding of who Trump was when they elected him, and these Republicans still prevailed. So I think they see that a denationalization of their own districts and saw the evidence of that in 16.
It's a really good point. And yet, Elena, there's also evidence in many places, maybe not everywhere, right? Maybe not in Valadao's district. We've talked about John Katko in upstate New York as another interesting example of this. But there does seem to be some inklings in the kind of arguments that Democrats are making, like a kind of check and balance argument, that what worked in 2016, when a lot of people might have thought Donald Trump wasn't actually going to win the presidency, might be very different now that he is in the White House.
All right. Well, Scott, you have to stop previewing my stories now for everyone so that they can actually read it first. No, I think that this is a really interesting question as to, you know, the exactly what David said. I do hear this from Republicans, and I have absolutely no doubt that a handful of these incumbents, Kaufman, Comstock, Curbelo, Hurd, Valadao, one or two of those may very well come through this just fine, and will be hailed as sort of the antibiotic resistant incumbent for the rest of time, but I think that they're up against a different set of circumstances, and I wonder. And we're going to, I think, explore this in the next 6 weeks as to how Democrats are talking to voters differently, that there is a different messaging that comes out of, well, yes, he was on the ballot in 2016, but now he's actually president. And there is a difference there. We've seen 2 years of not coverage of Hillary Clinton's presidency, but of the Trump presidency. And there certainly seems to be, from based on the voters that I've talked to and the data that we've seen, that there is a real power in the check and balance message. And I think that that's certainly what Democrats are going to lean hard on and take places like Jason Lewis and Angie Craig in the Minneapolis suburbs, where they're going to have another rematch where Jason Lewis was able to win that suburban district. But Angie Craig is going to go back there with a check and balance argument. And it still remains to be seen whether or not that's going to actually be effective. But it's going to be really interesting to watch how that district might perform differently in 2018 versus 2016.
Mm-hmm. Same candidates, same district.
But totally, a very different environment.
Totally different circumstances. That's a really interesting point. That's one to watch. Thanks, guys, for joining us to talk through all that. David, thank you for hopping on the phone with us.
Thank you.
And Elena, thank you as always for being here in the studio.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, that was a great show today. Thank you so much to our guests, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Nerdcast was produced this week by Jenny Ament with help from Adrian Hurst. Dave Shaw is our executive producer, and our illustrator is Bill Cookman. If you like Nerdcast and you're listening on Apple Podcasts, do us a favor and leave a review. It helps new listeners find the show. Once again, thank you so much for listening. We will talk to you again next week.